Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Salieri Report. The man who joins us today, the Saker, needs no introduction. We're here to talk about the emerging multipolar world with very much a focus on Russia. So, Saker, welcome. You have a brand new big piece about Russia, and I thought it was a great summary of where we are. So welcome, and why don't we dive in? Tell us about your new article.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And are you referring to the one about the next presidential election or the one on Belarus, which I released today?
Well, actually, I want to talk about both, but the newest one that I saw was the presidential election. And I'm fascinated because looking at what is going on from the Russian side, I think it's fascinating, but also trying to figure out, before I read your article, I was looking at the Financial Times interview that they did of Putin last year again, the second time I watched it. And I thought, strategically, what in the world would I do if I was in the leadership shoes in Russia? What would I do? And then I read your article and I said, oh, it's as really difficult as it seems.
Well, for Russia, I think the main problem now with the United States is that there's absolutely nobody to talk to.
Right.
I mean, I think that Putin has always, particularly in his younger years, he's always, he wanted a dialogue and some kind of good relationship with the West.
Right.
And I think that over the years, the Russians have become convinced that they know that, you know, both the Democrats and the Republicans don't really believe all that silly propaganda about Russia intervening in the elections and Skripal and all that stuff. That's clearly nonsense. But what is not nonsense is that Russia is needed as alongside with China in a different role, is very much needed as a boogeyman, as the one, first of all, the one party to scare everybody with, and secondly, the one to blame everything on. I mean, it's so funny. I was looking the Western articles about Russia stealing vaccine secrets from the U.S., I think, and I predicted that, you know, that is basically the deep state preparing the world for Russia getting a workable vaccine before everybody else, including before the country, the city on the hill. And so right now, Russia has really acquired sort of an important psychological function for the West, which is completely something internal to the West and that Russia can't really use in any way, shape, or form. So I think that Russia is basically giving up, I would say.
So there are two things I wanted to bring up. I normally don't dip into this, but I've been watching the progress in the Michael Flynn case. Mm-hmm. And what has come out in testimony, including with Sally Yates, regarding what the Obama administration did with the Brits to set up a phony case against Russia. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what's come out and how public this is, if I was the Russians, I would be sort of, you know, in a state of shock, other than it's same old, so they can't get shocked about it. But it's amazing how childish the whole thing is and how, you know, you just, if you tried to make this up as science fiction, you know, it would just seem silly. Mm-hmm. So as you look at the whole story come out, it's, to me, the childishness of it is shocking. But then we now have a new wave of accusations against Russia rigging the 2020 election.
Yeah, it has happened already, predicting it's going to be rigged by Russia.
Right. And so the facts clearly have no relevance to the story. The story is indifferent to facts, and it just keeps playing like a broken record. And if I were the Russians, I would seriously, you know, I don't know. I keep wondering what it's going to do to, in practical sense, whether it's trade or financial matters, that one, America is non-agreement capable, and two, is behaving as though it's lost its mind.
Well, you have to see that, first of all, and I've mentioned that several times in the past, if you look carefully at the Russian statement before the previous election. It is not true that Russia was thrilled with Trump. Vladimir Zhirinovsky was. But the Kremlin was always sort of, you know, very, very low-key. And I think my explanation is that they had a correct psychological profile of Trump. They knew that this was headed nowhere. And today, I mean, basically, if Biden wins, we're going to have the Republicans blame China for it. And if Trump wins, then we're going to have the Democrats blame Russia for it. I mean, it's a complete no-go. I mean, there's nothing you can do that's even semi-constructive with a country that basically is completely self-absorbed because of the importance of what's taking place. And I think that what's taking place in the United States is historical and huge. Right. I find it scary, but it's certainly huge. And I think what the Russian position has been from the get-go, the first step was very evidently self-protection. They decided a couple of years ago already that there is a risk of war, they need to prepare for that. I would say this is practically done. So now this part is taken care of. The next step
but
is,
are they concerned for war with Russia or war between the United States and China?
Well, any war between those three countries would have a huge impact.
Right.
So they're concerned about that. But the first thing they needed to do is make basically a conventional war in Europe against NATO impossible. You have to realize that for many, many years, there were no Russian divisions standing between Moscow and NATO on the Western direction. That came later. There were only brigade-sized forces there. Right. And the Western Front, for years in Russia, it was considered laughable to think that NATO would attack Russia. So there was really very little effort put into that. The effort was more towards the South. Now, this has changed over the past year. It's very, very profoundly. I mean, we went from having, you know, brigade-sized units on the Western Front to having actually now a First Guards tank army. I mean, it's a shock army that has been recreated, that existed during World War II. It's an extremely powerful formation. So that's really, the first thing was self-protection. The next one, I think, is then, it's this huge topic in Russia, it's import substitution. Not only because of sanctions, but also because of the pandemic, because of the worldwide crisis, and so on. Right. Russia is trying really hard to become self-sufficient. And to the degree that she can do it, she sees China as the primary market where to get things or sell things.
How far do you think they've come since the sanctions started?
Very, very, very far. Including in extremely advanced and very sophisticated items. For instance, engine construction, which is one of the... There's only a few countries on the planet that can build a good aircraft or even ship engine. And Russia imported some of those. And the fact that they can actually now build their own engines, if you want, it sort of shows you a degree of technological capability, because you have to have a lot of suppliers and a lot of know-how to be able to build that, and they did. Same thing for thermal imaging systems, same thing for pipes, same things for alloys in aircraft. Russia has been really extremely, you know, I would say almost in a maniacal determination to achieve as much autonomy from foreign markets as possible. And I think they did a good job on it, very much.
Right. Right. Now, I don't know if you noticed this. I didn't mention it when I sent you my notes. China just imposed sanctions as a result of what's going on in Hong Kong to Americans, including several American senators. So,
I saw that.
So the sanction regime is now reverberating seriously.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And China has the means to do that.
Right. Right. It's going to get very interesting.
Yes.
Okay. You also had a piece on Belarus. And Belarus is not something that gets a lot of coverage in the West. So explain what's happening between Russia and Belarus and what it means.
Oh, that's a complicated one, because indeed it's rarely covered. And Belarus is sort of a really different case from all the other post-Soviet republics.
Right.
I would summarize it by saying it's a one-man regime. Lukashenko has been in power for God knows how long now. He is, the usual image was that Belarus is extremely well controlled by the local KGB, which actually kept the name KGB. They didn't change the name. They have a very strong and very well-trained and equipped military, but it's a poor country. It's a relatively sparsely populated. There are only 10 million of them.
Do you know what their major export is?
Yes, actually, what do you call it in English? I've been looking for the word. Sea products.
Okay.
And mind you, it's a
landlocked country. Which is very valuable right now.
Yeah, but it's a landlocked country, so they're getting it from somewhere. Right. They're cutting from other places. So basically, the big export right now of Belarus to Russia, there are some legitimate exports, absolutely, including trucks, including technologies. I mean, there's a lot, but often people laugh in Russia saying that, you know, we got the shrimp from Belarus, or we got this something else from Belarus. And it's clearly, it's a black market. I mean, it's basically...
Yeah.
They're basically making a lot of money from bypassing the sanctions for Russia and exporting things under the Belarusian
stamp. Oh, how funny. Stamp. Yeah. So but it's sanction arbitrage.
Coming back to your question about, you know, the background of Belarus, the thing is that Lukashenko was what I call, you know, the famous saying, you know, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Uh-huh. Well, I think Lukashenko was a son of a bitch for the Kremlin. And I think that's a real problem because though he did, and he still controls the country fairly well, and he probably won the election fairly, just not by 80%. So he probably, you know, massaged the election figures, and now there's violence very similar to what happened right at the Euromaidan in Kiev. And everybody is, I mean, I'm skipping a lot of details here not to have a long lecture. But the situation there, very similar to what happened in 2014. And that's a real danger for Russia because while Belarus is not very important to Russia in terms of economics, it is culturally completely Russian. No difference between Russia and Belarus from that point of view, historically or culturally. And it's militarily extremely important. And there's a lot of violence. I mean, they had a second night of violence, so I don't know where this is going to head, but this is definitely a major... major risk for Russia.
Do you have any sense of where the violence is coming from?
Yes, very similar thing. Youth groups organized by social media. Now, the regime in Belarus doesn't even really want to pretend too hard to be too democratic. They disconnected the internet for a couple of days. I don't know if it's reconnected now. That's one of the ways they tried to get a grasp on that. But these are basically the same people we saw in the Euromaidan in Kiev. Young groups organized, but clearly the same methods, same, you know, color right. revolution. It's all the same. Nothing new happening from that point of view. What is strange is that the behavior of the Belarusian officials has been wishy-washy. They say, oh, why? Maybe it's the West, maybe it's Russia, because there is definitely an anti-Russian faction in the government, including the Minister of Foreign Affairs, who's definitely very anti-Russian. And I think my perception is that Belarus has been effectively infiltrated. That's what I think. Just as the Ukraine was before that.
Right. You know, it's very interesting for the Let's Go to the Movies this week on the Salary Reporter last week when this runs. I have a series of videos that was made by an Australian documentary maker of what happened in Evergreen College in 2017 out in Oregon. And it focuses on interviewing two professors who are basically science professors who stood up to the kind of lawlessness. Anyway, if you go to the commentary, there's a link to a tweet with Brett Weinstein, who's the lead sort of science professor who tried to stand up to the Lord of the Flies kind of madness. And one of the things he said was, you know, you can't let ideas like this take hold because what it does is it destroys the basis that civilization rests on. And he said, if you let these ideas take hold, civilization can stop.
What kind of ideas are you referring to?
What happened at the in Oregon, and it's hard because the ideas are so unclear and incoherent. It's hard to answer. But basically what they're saying is there is longstanding systemic racism, and they created an equity council to create equity. And then they, as part of all of this, they created an environment where no one was able to speak freely. And if they did speak freely and said something that was upsetting to the Equity Council. They literally got bullied and physically threatened and run off campus. Mm-hmm. And the police couldn't come in. And I mean, you had real serious lawlessness and people's physical safety being jeopardized. You know, it was a very Lord of the Flies kind of scene.
But that physical safety is very important because we see the methodology. The methodology is take any protest, and most initial protests have a very valid reason to protest. I completely understand that people can protest against police violence in the U.S. or against the kind of, you know, heavily secret service regime like they had in Syria, mm-hmm. or that they would protest against Lukashenko. I fully understand that. But what happens is that an external interest identify the protest and then inject themselves into it precisely to trigger a situation of violence. And at that point, you sort of reach an escape velocity. Chaos becomes so out of control that basically you won. That's simple, really.
Right. Well, so if you look at the Antifa and BLM looting, you know, I wasn't in the United States as it was happening, but I was watching it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could say many things about it, but none of what they were doing was making any progress on the issues they said they cared about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. I agree.
So it's a highly counterproductive, destructive, you know, frankly, I think a lot of the activities make it easier for the establishment to clear out black neighborhoods in a way that's very, very harmful to the minority populations. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. to me, it's air cover for something much darker. But, you know, the impression you get when you listen to the material is it's a very illogical and incoherent conversation. I think it's just a front for something else.
But see, there's something really important here is that I don't see that as much as a deliberate plan as a sort of a consequences of the dynamic that we see. I can explain what I mean here. I think that the Western regimes are very, very weak. And when you're weak, you can take up small tasks, but not big tasks. And to build something, to offer something constructive, to actually get a policy that will improve something is extremely labor intensive, very right. hard, and take years.
Right.
The kind of energy that you need to create violence and chaos is tiny in comparison.
Right.
It takes very little skills.
Right.
I mean, basically, it's the same thing as, you know, making a beautiful vase or smashing a beautiful vase.
Right.
And I think that a lot of what we see is basically because the leaders of the empire are unable to do anything else. All they're good at is smashing vases. They've right. never built a vase. Give me one case where they actually built something. I mean, in Afghanistan, the US is still using Soviet facilities. Tell you something.
Right, and I hate to say it right now in America, for, you know, $10 an hour through an app, you can get a lot of people to destroy things.
Yes, absolutely. And the same thing in Belarus, by the way. And we right. already know that people were paid, they were bussed around. I mean, it's all the same thing. We're seeing very similar, stuff happening. They're already using Molotov cocktails in Minsk this night, and everybody's afraid now and waiting with very serious concern that firearms might be used. And considering that the Ukraine is flooded with military-grade firearms,
right?
You know, if somebody wants guns in Belarus, they're going to appear.
Right. Well, I was just on the horn with someone from Chicago who doesn't travel in Chicago without his guns.
Yes, I even heard something weird. They lifted bridges to prevent looting in Chicago.
Yeah, he said if I wanted to get out of Chicago right now, I couldn't. All the you know, avenues to get out have been plugged by the police. They put equipment up and you're basically locked in.
See, we are in a situation of quasi insurrection. It's really bad. We're living, I have to say, 2020 has turned out to be a perfect storm. It really did.
Well, I don't think wherever we are now, it's just the beginning. Because if you look just as the nuts and bolts of the practical situation, you've got 11 to 15 million people who are subject to eviction the next 4 months. Mm-hmm. And many more are struggling with mortgage payments. One person the other day, one doctor from Ohio, told me that a recent poll they had seen said 50% of the people who were had lost their income were planning on basically supporting themselves over the next year or two by selling their house. So if you look at the sort of vise that the American people are going to go into for lack of income and continuing expenses, that vise is going to tighten dramatically over the next 3 to 6 months.
Yes.
And I have no way to predict what might come out of that. And I don't think it's just the United States. I think it's all over the world.
I completely agree with all of what you said. I agree with you. It's impossible to predict it now. There's simply too many variables.
Right.
I think the election is going to make things much, much worse and will solve nothing. And I expect all it will do is accelerate everything. So I think the election is going to be a disaster, and the months before and after are going to be an absolute catastrophe. And I think the economic system is going to hurt so much that it will indeed bleed into the rest of the planet. I mean, I don't see Europe doing well with America. They have a leverage there. And if the U.S. hurts, you know, Europe is going to follow right after that.
So Europe, you know, so I've been in Europe since February, and Europe seems much calmer and more sensible, much more grounded. And I think, you know,
I don't know
people
about
are
that.
Struggling. What?
I was saying, I don't know about that.
I don't know. You know, it could just be the countries I'm in, because I'm in Northern Europe. But I just
find first of all, there were BLM demonstrations in the Northern Europe, too.
Yeah, there were. There were some in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
That I
and
know
in the
of,
UK,
yeah.
I believe. So that's already weird. I mean, why do Europeans suddenly...
For example, Berlin had 800,000 to 1 million people protesting the pandemic restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nothing like that has happened in the U.S. that I know of.
Well, because demonstrations in the U.S. don't really make sense either. I mean, it's sort of a... It reminds me of this joke that says, you know, dictatorship is shut up and a democracy is keep talking. And I think partially, I'm not excusing it in any way, shape, or form, but I think partially the violence and the looting and the overboard kind of demonstration is also a consequence of the fact of keep talking doesn't work. So they want to raise their, you know, raise their voice, sort of speak, and to be noticed.
Right.
Now, the way they do it is extraordinarily dangerous, in my opinion. I think it's absolutely, there's no justification for it. I am a law and order person completely. I do not think that, I have no particular love for the cops or for the state, but I think it's better to have a bad state than have no state, that's for sure,
right.
At least in my opinion. And I think we're going to see a lot of, once the social fabric, which, you know, holds a country together, starts breaking because nobody really shares anything with others. You're going into a cycle of atomization and violence, which I think is going to affect Europe too. Plus, in Europe, there's an amazing problem of immigrants.
Right. It can't not. So let's go back to Russia, because it appears to me, so Russia was dealing with many years of the sanctions, and then the COVID, the pandemic hit. And that's clearly been, you know, very tough on the domestic product, on the GDP.
Yes.
But it seems that Putin's popularity continues. It's gotten hurt a little bit, but it seems to continue reasonably well despite all the sort of tough sledding. Does that make sense?
It does, but it's due to a weird combination of circumstances. First, I think the biggest one is there is no alternative to him. I mean, people who are critical of Putin, including myself in certain aspects of what he does, if not him, then who? And that's the first thing. Secondly, the opposition, right now, there's roughly three kinds of oppositions in Russia. One, an official one in the Duma, which is pretty irrelevant. Then there is, you know, a pro-US liberal non-system opposition, and then probably a slightly bigger, you know, neo-Marxist nationalist kind of opposition that wants a much firmer stance. None of the, they have, all these oppositions have not managed to produce either a credible candidate or a credible program.
Right.
So sort of Putin is enjoying a one-man show, but that's not necessarily healthy, particularly in the long run.
Right. So if you were Putin, I know we covered this, but if you were Putin and you were facing a U.S. and a West that was in the situation it's in, does this give you an opportunity to get rid of what you call the Atlanticists, the supporters of the U.S. and European?
Yes, it can, it should, and it did. Putin has already reduced the number of people, the Atlantic integrationists that are up there in the government. They're still there, some of them. But basically, even the latest reforms, the latest change in the Constitution, I mean, clearly the Atlantic integrationists are losing power.
Right.
And they're sort of keeping a low profile. I think much more dangerous for Putin is the nationalistic left opposition, which is dangerous for two reasons. First, many of what they say is actually true, makes them much more credible than the liberal opposition,
right,
which use nonsense. And secondly, unfortunately, I think they have such a personal hatred of Putin that they're constantly, you know, they're not calling for a violent insurrection, but they're warning of one. And clearly,
why
you know, that's
hate,
their
why
wish.
Do they hate
they
Putin?
Want. I think mostly because Putin has created a type of society where they are not prized in that kind of society.
Right.
Putin has created a society which is, first of all, economically speaking, is very liberal, democratic, and, you know, sort of capitalist. These people have much stronger social views. And I agree with them here. I deplore that Putin is so much of a, you know, neoliberal in terms of economics.
Right.
They think that Putin should be much firmer with the West, and I agree to some degree with that. I would say they're correct about that. And they're fed up with the corruption and the fact that, you know, there is this perception, and partially a justified one, that the Kremlin, you know, is representing the interests of big Russian money, not of the common Russian people. Now, actually, the common Russian people still vote Putin regularly and put him back to power with strong majorities. So
Right. The
people who accuse him of that actually disagree with the people that they claim to represent and whose interests they claim to protect.
It was interesting in the Financial Times interview, and again, this was 2019, the interviewer asked one question about oligarchs, and Putin, forget exactly how he said it, but he insisted that, you know, the oligarchs were gone, that problem had been solved. Is that an exaggeration?
It all depends on your definition. If you call an oligarch simply a very rich guy, no, they still exist in Russia. But I think in Russia, what's understood under oligarch is a different concept, is a very rich guy who uses his money to influence power.
Right.
Which we saw under Yeltsin. Under Yeltsin, he was basically ruled by seven bankers.
Right.
And in that sense, they don't exist anymore. Putin is not accountable to anybody. He is the top power. And he has forced the oligarch to either emigrate, resign, or, you know, get the message and stick to business and not try to overthrow the society the way Khodorkovsky and others did in the 90s.
So if Russia is going to defend itself or protect itself from encroachment by the U.S., what's it going to do? So if it's going to get tougher, in addition to trying to be more economically self-sufficient, what does it do vis-a-vis NATO and the United States?
First of all, I would say that every time that Russia acted firmly, the West basically accepted it. Secondly, I would say that I do not believe that Russia is at risk of a Western military attack anymore. And that's a huge difference. It changes the dynamic in a major way.
What changed that?
The fact that Russia's been rearming like crazy for the past decade.
Right.
And rearming doesn't even begin to cover it. It's training, it's the social image of people serving in the military. It's huge investments in equipment. About 80% of all the military equipment of the Russian military now is new. I mean, That's very, very advanced. So there was a massive effort that got a lot of people very critical of Putin. They were saying, you know, why do you put so much money in the military? Well, I think he never could. He actually did spell it out several times, and other people did. Russia needed to plug the hole in the Western direction and sort of make herself safe before she acts.
Right.
Now, the way she should act, I'll tell you one thing. The first thing, she should ditch non-viable concept. This union state, supra-union state between Russia and Belarus are both sovereign states, but also have a union state above them. That's nonsense. I think what Russia should do right now is rapidly to engage a process of full reintegration of Belarus into Russia and become a unitary state. That would completely solve the problem. There is a reason why it happens in Belarus and in Kaliningrad, which is even further, you would say, and more isolated and much smaller. Once you're part of Russia, you're safe.
Right.
If you're not, you're sitting in a very precarious position.
And if there was a referendum in Belarus today, what do you think the vote would be?
I honestly do not know. Traditionally, I know that Belarusians have always been very, you know, I mean, it's basically one nation with the Russians. But right. There are in Western Belarus, there are nationalists. It's nothing like in the Ukraine. But, you know, you don't need necessarily to have a national identity. If I look at the demonstrations, a lot of young people there, it could be a social fracture in the country that could threaten it. So would most people want to join Russia? I suspect that yes, if only because that would guarantee them social, economic, and political stability. So I would say yes, there's probably a majority who would agree to that. But am I sure of it? No.
No.
And can that change very rapidly depending on what Lukashenko and Russia do right now? Yes, it could change.
So Trump announced a pullout of troops from Germany. And obviously one of the things that can be affected by this election is what happens, the future of NATO. So what was that about? What was the point of announcing a pullout of troops from Germany?
It's a mix of a couple of things. I think Trump is definitely frustrated with Merkel and with Germany. They have a very tense relationship between the two countries anyways. He wanted to show, I mean, he did say in his election promises that he wanted to bring troops home. It's not what happened in this case. Some of them are supposed to go home. Some of them, I think, went to Belgium and Italy. But basically sort of bringing more people home. And at the same time, he thinks of it as a sanction against Germany. Very funny. I think most Germans would be happy for all Americans to back and leave, including their nuclear weapons. I think it's just one of those things that Trump does from time to time, which don't really make much sense or are not part of a thought through reorganization, repositioning kind of strategy. One argument could have been, you know, to move towards Brussels is to moving back, and moving towards Italy is also moving back. And that sort of reflects the reality of the Russian strike capabilities now with Russian cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. I think it makes more sense for NATO to not be forward deployed. But then we have at the same time the U.S. and Poland in negotiations to deploy part of these, at least a fairly significant force inside Poland. I don't think any of that makes sense. It's not a policy. And I've been saying that on this show many, many times. We should not assume that every time Uncle Sam does something, there's a policy.
That makes any sense. Right.
Does that make any sense? Uncle Sam does a lot of things because he does a lot of things without any need for facts, rationale, or any policy.
Well, sometimes you just need a headline.
That's it. Absolutely. I think that's it. That's absolutely it. And I think Trump is trying desperately to find something before the elections to get his popularity back up.
So here's the question. Do you think Trump really wants to win?
I have no idea. You know, I don't think he really thought he would be elected the first time around.
Right.
And prove it.
Right.
But my gut feeling, he didn't really believe it would happen to him. Does he want to win? I think his enemies in the Democratic Party of the deep state hate him. I don't particularly think he likes them very much, but he's a very, you know, he's a spineless man. He doesn't have much in terms of staying power to strike back. Look at the way he completely...
Well, here was the problem. When the Supreme Court ordered that Deutsche Bank had to give his tax returns to the New York prosecutors, the next day he showed up at Walter Reed with a mask on, which told me, you know, they got him on a leash. And then the next thing he did was he pardoned Roger Stone because he can't afford for the New York prosecutors to have Stone and his tax returns. So mm-hmm. This is a man who's now, you know, if he wasn't in the corner before, he's definitely in the corner now.
But he's still not fighting very much. I mean, he could have used the entire Rudy Giuliani trip to Ukraine and all the corruption of the Bidens in the Ukraine in a much more effective way than he did.
And why didn't he?
There's one more thing. He cannot fight the people who use Russia as a pretext to destroy him, while at the same time parroting the memes and, you know, the lies about Russia. And he does that. Right. And the Republicans are just as Russophobic. And listen to Pompeo.
Right.
He's just as bad as any neocon of the Democrats.
Right. So I've never understood Pompeo because he makes no sense to me. And
same here.
I can't, you know, I just feel like I'm watching a whirling dervish, and he doesn't have any framework. He doesn't have a worldview. He doesn't have. There's no vision of.
Oh, yes, I think there is a vision. Well, I very much disagree here. I think he's this typical messianic imperialist. The vision is, you know, it's self-worship. It is it's narcissism pushed at its extreme. And I think the guy is completely delusional. I mean, he's just as delusional as Trump when he was talking about, you know, Rocket Man and my butt is bigger than yours. It's the kind of people we have now in power here. Long gone are the James Baker.
So one of the things I spend a lot of time trying to understand what's going on is in space. And the Chinese have clearly made a major investment in building their space program. And the interesting thing about space is basically the U.S. has taken all the treaties and thrown them up in the air. Mm-hmm. And so there's no legal framework for what's going on in space around us. You know, it's kind of the Wild West.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely.
The interesting thing about space is if one party controls space, they control everything on the planet. And so one of the things I expect is a serious space race. And that's why I'm very interested to see what Xi and China are going to do in the face of sort of the economic pressures from the pandemic. You know, will they keep building out the Navy or will they keep building out space? You know, what are they going to do? How are they going to handle this?
I think they're going to do both. And I really do not think that the United States has a strong position in space at all. I mean, right now, yes, if you judge by the number of satellites a nation has put up in orbit, the U.S. is far ahead of everybody else, just in a raw amount. But if you actually look at, I'm sort of interested in this topic as an amateur, I'm not a specialist, but from what I understand, this entire privatization of space of Elon Musk and the rest of them has been pretty much a gimmick. And even right now, you know, they say the US is back in space. Yeah, but you know what? The launches that they have are not exactly, they're in a very difficult position and they seem to be having now second thoughts about the space station. I think what's going to happen is probably Russia and China will be working together and we'll just abandon and ditch the US. That's the most likely
thing. See, so to me, what's most interesting,
go ahead.
Yeah, so what's most interesting here is China has the bodies and Russia has the deep experience. And so the question is, how closely will Russia and China work together, you know, on space, including creating a legal framework for operations in space? And to me, if I was in Putin's chair, that's one place I would invest. I would make an incredible investment in trying to build out, because the combination is unbelievably powerful.
But here's the deal. I don't think the U.S. currently right now has any interest in any form of international law. And it's not dependent on...
No, but that's why if Russia and China go to work together, you know, they have, between the two of them, an ability to really make progress. But you're right. The U.S. has no interest whatsoever.
And I think the U.S. is now technologically actually behind Russia and China in many technologies. So I don't really see that as a, I don't think it's going to happen. I know Trump said he's going to create space forces. But again, Trump has all been about, you know, public perception and slogans, not about actually getting anything done. And the only thing the U.S. really got done, the crucial thing, is they didn't want the Chinese on the International Space Station.
Well, they did create a space force and they did fund it. So in terms of organizing how space works in the U.S. bureaucracy, there is a change.
Yeah, but what can they do? with it. I mean, right now they're freaking out over Russian observation satellites.
Right.
I don't know if you followed that, about those micro satellites were launched from another satellite and then come and take photos, etc. They're clearly concerned about
Here's, I think, what the issue is. And you can see it when you look at what the Chinese have accomplished in space. If you are going to have a really great, effective space presence and accomplish great things in space over the next 20 years, the thing you need to do that is you need to be agreement capable. You know, because you're talking about a major institutional effort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes institutions, it takes organizations, it takes academia, it takes science, it takes, you know, so you have to make thousands and thousands of agreements and get people to go to work on things that won't come to fruition in their lifetime. It's like building cathedrals, you know, mm-hmm. it was in the old days. Mm-hmm. And a mm-hmm. culture that's not agreement capable can't do that. That's the problem.
Here's another, I think, key problem. I think the U.S. has been infected by its own ideology. I personally do not believe at all that space should be privatized. I think what you're describing, precisely because of the long cycle, precisely the kind of effort needed, I think only states can run an effective space program.
I agree.
And I do believe just as much as the space shuttle initially was a masterpiece of technology and a fundamental mistake in terms of getting things done in space. Right now, I see this ideological, you know, pushing forward of, you know, sending cars in space, etc. It's a gimmick, but this is not going to be a solid space program.
Well, but here's what I would think about, because I think this is deeper and much worse than you do. I think they would like to privatize everything. So I think they
yes.
have taken the Treaty of Westphalia and torn it up. And what they're saying is corporations can run places and corporations
yes.
can regulate industries and corporations can run space. And they basically are looking at, you know, if you go back and you study the East India Company or the Dutch West Indies Company, I think they think you can go back to that model, not just for, you know, space, but for the entire military industrial complex.
I completely agree with you. And
right.
I think it's one of the biggest weaknesses because
absolutely,
I understand why Americans don't like government. I do. I lived in this country for over 20 years. And I don't
they love government. Government prints all the money.
Yeah, but
in other
government
words,
doesn't function very well either. And Americans
oh,
know that.
Oh, the government runs Saker. The government runs perfectly for what it's supposed to do. I totally disagree with you.
Yeah, but
the
I think government
is supposed to,
do other
to pour profits into the corporations and to get the population to do everything the corporations want and the investors want. And it
That's
works.
That's absolutely
perfectly.
True again.
Right.
I think this is an idiosyncrasy of the United States. Governments in Europe, for all their failings, I think are much more deserving of gratitude, and you
yes,
sort of get a sense
absolutely.
Where your taxes go.
Absolutely.
You know where your taxes go, whereas here
right.
you don't know where they go.
Right, absolutely.
And I agree with you that the U.S. is trying to privatize everything, and I think that's a fundamental, profound mistake.
No, but here's the fact. They've tried to privatize everything while growing government to
yes.
protect and feed the corporation. So you're the worst of both worlds.
It's exactly it. It's the worst of both worlds. I agree with you.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree. And it's having very serious impact because it impacts research.
No kidding.
It impacts education. Once the government desists from this obligation of strategic services that are needed for the health of a society and corporations take over, well, all you have is people making money off your back. That's all you're
right.
achieving, in my opinion.
Well, I keep, you know, one of the things I keep talking to my subscribers about is I said, look, if you can't use the schools in your district and you have to homeschool for a whole variety of reasons we don't need to get into, you know, you can't afford to pay for the school. Your real estate taxes are funding the school, but you can't use it because they're mandating all sorts of things that, you know, will destroy your kid or make the
Listen,
education not useful.
It happened
so,
to my family.
Yeah.
Yeah, all my kids were homeschooled, and we had to pay taxes for the local schools. They there took our money and stuck it in the local schools, never gave us anything.
Well, but that repeats again and again and again. So one of the beauties of the pandemic, the healthcare companies, insurance companies are making a fortune because everybody has to pay their premium, but they can't go to the doctor. They can't get elective surgeries. So so the insurance companies are saving a fortune, but you have to pay, but you can't get the service. And increasingly, you know, this is part of the economics. And to me, if you basically, the pandemic is the ultimate, and I'm going to grossly oversimplify, you know, I run the central bank. I tell you, your business is non-essential. My business is essential, so I can take over your customers and your business. And meantime, I print money and give it to my business, you know, to go buy up and run everything. And it's basically a buyout with printed money of the whole economy.
That's exactly it.
Right.
Yeah. The same way they're distributing money right now. I mean, the way they're dealing with the crisis is printing money and just distributing it. It's unsustainable.
Well, it's funny because, you know, I, in the last 4 months, I cannot tell you how many times I have heard your voice in my head say, America is not agreement capable. Now, you were talking about Lavrov talking about the ability to make diplomatic agreements. But what I'm thinking about is the ability for, you know, many different players within the American constellation being able to make and keep agreements with each other.
Mm-hmm. So coming back to your question about what Russia should or should not do towards the West, I would say, right now, I think they're simply waiting, seeing how relationships between Western countries are degrading. And they don't need to do anything for it. It's happening by itself. All they need is to be patient. Just wait.
Well, but here's what's interesting. The G7 and the Anglo-American Alliance together are working on their crypto plan. And with the Bank of International Settlements and the Swiss National Bank, they're all together in a group working on the G7 crypto plan and on building sort of a network between the Fed and the BIS globally. And what's very interesting, Putin just passed a law that said crypto is an asset and cannot be used for payment within Russia. And the Russian Central Bank is not part of that working group, not the G7 part, not the Anglo-American Alliance part. And my interpretation of that, and this is just a guess, is that was Putin saying nobody's going to be able to fiddle with our monetary system internally through crypto. Now, they announced that they're coming out with a new bill related to crypto later this year. I have no idea what's going to be in it.
Yeah, the thing is, I think Russians have realized, first of all, that the sanctions were really a blessing in disguise, and that these sanctions prepared them, actually, for the current situation much better. And I think they see, a lot of Russians see advantages into what's going on
right now. I agree.
The fact of basically, it's a process of sovereignization.
Right.
That's what I would say is happening in Russia. Russia is still a moving target, still, you know, a project in progress. But the direction is very clear, sovereignization.
Right.
And that's how they see their security, by being not dependent on the empire.
And the same thing that happened to Russia is happening to every family in America, and every family in America should take the same lesson away.
Yeah, absolutely correct. Yes.
Right.
It is.
Right. I still think this is all going to come down to two visions, one which is human and one which is not human. And the question is, you know, how do the people who are for a human civilization find each other and make sure a human civilization is what happens? Let me just quick ask you a question. I keep being told that, you know, Russia offers land and opportunity for people who want to move there. Is that really the case?
There have been very successful cases that got attention from the media, and in Russia and abroad. But I would say, don't underestimate the complexity of moving to a country with a different language, different culture, history. It is hard. I think that moving to Russia is an option that's good for some young people who have specific skill sets that could be used there very much. It's definitely a much happier and more stable and healthy society. But I'm afraid of people who say, you know, they want to go to Russia because they're fed up with the homo lobby and riots and you know, the kind of policy they see in the West. They'll go to Russia and find out that Russia has their own problems that are pretty severe too. It's not a paradise. People should not think of it as some kind of conservative paradise. It is not. It is a very fluid, it's a complex situation. It's a complex society, and it still is a work in progress. We have no idea, and it's impossible to predict what Russia will look like in 5 years.
So I just finished writing a major piece that took me a year of research and writing called The State of Our Currencies. Mm-hmm. And basically what I say is, if you look at what the central bankers are doing, they're trying to extend the old system and really extend the dollar bubble and then accelerate the bringing up of the new system. And one of the things I make clear is, if you look at what they're up to, you know, they're kind of inventing it as they go. And when the core, you know, some of the core functions in the governance system of a society are in this much flux at the top, you know, things can get very fluid and chaotic in the middle and the bottom, mm-hmm. because things break down and the guys at the top are making it up as they go, and it's not figured out yet, let alone mature and risk managed. And so that mm-hmm. makes for a very, very chaotic situation everywhere.
Everywhere. That's the key point. It's everywhere. You know, I regularly get emails telling me, why don't you leave the U.S. and go and live in country XYZ? And I always reply, first of all, I don't think there's a geographical solution. And the problems really have become global.
Yeah.
There is no quick out here.
Right. I that's what I keep telling people. There is no away. Although I think I pointed out to you this, the first week of Obamacare, somebody incidentally came out with a website offering people a one-way trip to Mars. You know, who would like to go to Mars, but you couldn't come back. It was one way. And mm-hmm. I think 200,000 people signed up for a one-way trip to Mars and only 14,000 signed up for Obamacare that week. So it kind of
it tells you what kind of society we live in. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this has been very useful. You know, on one hand, I feel sorry for the Russians. On the other hand, I feel that they have earned themselves a unique place in the world.
And it's up to them, you know.
Yeah. It's a tough road, but it's a road worth traveling.
I think there's no other option. There is no other option.
Yes, it's true. If you look at their option, it's the same option we have.
Yeah.
How are we going to preserve sovereignty?
Yes.
How are we going to preserve sovereignty in the middle of World War III? Well, before we finish, any other thoughts looking ahead in the next quarter?
That is a no-brainer for me. The single most important issue is law and order in the United States.
Right.
Will the country, the nation as a whole, be able to restore and guarantee law and order? Or is the country going to collapse in a kind of, you know, pre-revolutionary chaos? I can't say I'm very optimistic. I think it might be geographical. Some regions seem to be much better off than others. I have to say, here in Florida, I get a sense that our sheriffs here are going to mean business. But when I look at what happens elsewhere, I don't know.
If you look at the finances, the debt, and the pensions at the state level, what you find is there's tremendous variation in the financial soundness and stability of the different states.
Yes.
And where you're having problems is where you don't have, you know, the worst finances is where you're having the problems. And mm-hmm. That's to be expected. And I do think the states that have been very prudently managed, you will also see very strong sheriff associations and other internal collaborations that make for law and order. And it's amazing. There's one town in Tennessee that a fair amount of subscribers have moved to, and they have a great sheriff's office, and they, you know, it's very sort of law and order, very strong, lots of civic participation. And I talked to one of the subscribers who had moved there many years ago, and he said, you know, don't introduce me to any more people. The houses prices have doubled in the last 2 years, and people are flowing in here from all over the country looking for, you know, a place with law and order. And, you know, we're having trouble managing the flow.
You know, it's particularly striking for somebody with Russian roots like myself, because it reminds me of what happened in Russia in the early 20th century. You know, there was a prime minister in Russia who wanted the Russian Duma at that time to condemn violence, political violence. And the Russian Duma refused to do so.
Wow.
And Solzhenitsyn mentioned after that, you know, most of the people in that Duma were either killed or had to run for their lives. And I see this. I see that there is a very substantial chunk of the U.S. elites who are basically caving in and surrendering to that chaos. And that is really, really frightening, because it doesn't end well when a state basically surrenders its ability to even impose and maintain law and order.
I think they're using as a I think the billionaires are using as a front so they can pick up a huge amount of assets cheap. I really do.
You know, if that's their plan, how do they plan to survive the fall? Because these millionaires are going to be at risk.
Right.
Wow. I mean, we're talking about civil war here. Yeah.
I mean, if you defund the police, then the guys who've got the mercenaries will control. And if you look at the difference at the prices they can pick up real estate and land, you know, it dramatically increases their yields. And I think they're stupid enough to really look at this as a rate of return proposition, and they don't understand what happens when civilization goes away and all bets are off.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that cheerful note.
Yes.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us on the Soleri Report.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Maybe I still maybe think we should all find an island.
If you find it, let me know.
I will. Thanks, Saker. You have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.